The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm here with sommelier from Don Alfonso. I'm on a run with Don Alfonso. Also used to work at Grand Cru Deli, which is how I met him, and it's Nathan Hooper. Nathan, thank you so much for doing the pod.
Thanks for having me, Matthew.
I want to start here because immediately when you were serving me and my girlfriend at Grand Cru, immediately, like, Amy and I just loved you. As someone who goes to restaurants all the time just because of what I do in this industry, you start to just appreciate good service. And it was immediate and you jumped out. And I just want to know, what does good service mean for you?
First of all, thanks so much. That's very kind. Good service is more of an interaction. You know, we call the front of house the service professionals, but really to move from service to hospitality is an important step. So in all the places I've worked, I've been fortunate enough to have good mentors in providing hospitality rather than service. So yeah, it's about a dialogue. It's about not doing everything, you know, the exact same way all the time. If it's muscle memory, that's great. And I think muscle memory is an important part of good hospitality, because you need to have, you know, all of this small things that are relatively insignificant but add up over the course of an evening. But taking it to that next step and suiting your guest needs and figuring out what they're interested, what they like, is kind of what gets that next step over the line.
And I just thought of, tell me if this is all right or wrong. The service is when they pour the glass and they go right to the line. So it's 5 ounces, not 5.1 ounces, not 4.9, but exactly 5 ounces. Hospitality is, there isn't a little line. You just pour them the glass of wine. Would that sort of, it's a bit of a generalization, but would that be one way to look at it?
Well, sure. I think there's, you know, there needs to be a sense of relaxation in good hospitality. But what I will say is, part of hospitality is also sustainability, and part of sustainability is doing things properly and mm-hmm. being profitable. And by being profitable, you're able to pay everybody
right.
a fair wage. So, you know, I've never been one to just fully, you know, throw caution to the wind. I think it's important as a business to make money, since margins are so slim. But yeah, there's a lot of truth to what you said. You
yeah.
know, you can't die on that hill of, you know, 5.1 or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and by that I mean, like, the favorite restaurants that I go to, like, my folks have their favorite place when they're in Florida. Mm-hmm. And the service all knows them there. It's like, oh, there's just a little bit of end of this bottle here. Just finish it off.
Right.
Because they also know we're sticking around for at least another glass. We're sticking around for at least another hour. And it's actually one thing I think about my folks. At one point, I remember we all used to make fun of them. Like, oh, they always go to the same restaurants. Like, well, wait a minute. The people front of house are almost like family, and they treat them in this nicer way. And there's a value to that that I think some people might not appreciate.
Yeah, I think you do have to kind of go that extra mile. There is difference between, you know, the people that you see on a recurring basis who, you know, are just as invested in the success of your business
right.
as you are in yeah. the success of their experience. So yeah, it is fair to say that that does alter the dynamic a little bit.
How tough, and I want to talk all about the wine competitions and your study and mm-hmm. your journey into wine. But there's been this, you know, the narrative recently is, you know, oh, wow, restaurants, everyone's coming back, but also restaurants are really expensive. Why is it so expensive? And it's not like the people that own these restaurants are making tons and tons of money. I was wondering if you could illustrate just how razor thin the margins are, even for the quote unquote fancy places.
Well, I mean, I can speak to the Liberty Group. You know, there's been this. Kind of unspoken or very quiet, you know, shame concept to fine dining restaurants, where they've run on the back of unpaid labor, and, you know, the interns, the stages, the, oh, you should be so lucky to
right.
to be able to set foot in our establishment. Liberty Group does not do that in any of its establishments. Every single person that's in these buildings is paid, and they're paid well, and they're looked after. It's something that's important to the group, and it's the difference between, you know, having a company that's family run versus you know, something that's owned by a corporate entity. So, you know, labor is, you talk to any restaurateur, labor is the number one thing that drives the cost there, and then of course using you know quality product, and you know, I mean, real estate, you know, there's been so much talk about the housing real estate market and all the prices that are going up there, but you know, it applies to restaurants as well. And you know, I think if your average diner took a look at even, you know, the fact that restaurants pay by the square foot, not by, you know, the acre or, or something like that, right? So yeah, the amount of money that these restaurants pay by the square foot, and then the staff and the product and everything like that, like, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There is this illusion that restaurateurs are, have their Scrooge McDuckie and vault of gold coins that they dive upon. But you know, the reality is, if a restaurant can clear, you know, just a couple of percent profit over the course of a year, then that's like a wildly successful restaurant, right? So yeah, it's definitely not that way.
No, and the hours that put in, you don't go into restaurants, same thing, you don't go into making wine for the love of money. You do it for the love of the product, of the food, of the hospitality, of all of that. So I remind people when they complain about a $35 bottle of Ontario wine, like, go to the Ontario winery, count all the Porsches. Now, when you see that number is zero, but there's a beat up, you know, a beat up hatchback, then maybe you can see why they're not making a ton of money on the wine.
If there is a Porsche, it's because the winery owner has done the very smart thing, which is get all of the money from another venture and then open a winery because they say, oh, you know, I think I have a little bit too much money. Let's actually whittle some of this away by owning a winery. So yeah, all the most successful wineries are done by people who have money to burn. It's not a money-making operation.
My wallet's too heavy. Yeah. Let's start a winery.
It's a great way to lose money.
Yeah. So let's talk about you and just your own wine journey. First off, I forget, what are you in the advanced level or in terms of the CMS, just for people listening, your own accreditations.
Yep. So I'm a certified sommelier.
Certified, yep.
Through the Quarter Master Sommeliers.
Yep.
Many moons ago, I did my WSET level 3. And, you know, at some point I hope to do the diploma, but goal number one and the thing that has informed all of my career moves in kind of recent couple of years is sitting the CMS advanced exam next year. So
right.
I'm sitting theory next spring for that.
Okay, we'll get into that in a second. But how did you first get, because the studying for that is just ridiculous. But what turned you on to wine, to hospitality?
To be perfectly candid, I was serving tables in a, you know, local pub in small town Niagara, which is where I grew up.
Yep.
And I was mopping floors at 1 a.m. one day and thought, you know, I would love a way to become a little bit more specialized. And wine was a great avenue for that. I think the first moment where I kind of realized there was something to be done there is, I remember in you know, again, small pub, small town Niagara, we had a wine list of, you know, maybe it was a dozen bottles, and maybe eight of those we poured by the glass, something like that. But I remember, you know, because we weren't selling a lot of wine, it was a pub, and so we obviously pour a lot of draft beer, mixed drinks, etc. But we had this small by the glass program, and I remember, you know, going onto the LCBO website and trying to figure, okay, well, what bottles under, I think it was $14, because that's what we could kind of afford to.
When was this? What time period was this?
Oh my goodness. Like not like it was long ago, like 2015 maybe.
Yep.
15, 16. You know, going through the LCBO website and trying to figure out, okay, well, what's cheap that we can pour that actually might be a little bit interesting. And then I would keep a little ledger when I would open the restaurant every day, and I would taste through all the wines, not in a really studious way, but just because I was worried about things getting stale. And so I think that was the first moment of kind of taking the extra step to try and figure out, okay, well, this is something that requires care and attention, and it kind of snowballed from there.
Was there a bottle in particular? And this is the question I ask in almost every podcast. And by the way, if there isn't one, it's fine. Some people are like, no, I just woke up one day and loved it. Other people can wax poetic about the certain bottle at that certain time, blah, blah, blah. Was there a bottle or a moment for you where you had sort of that epiphany?
I think there's maybe two. So easily the greatest and most fortunate career move. Well, actually, would be under very stiff competition. One of the first great career moves that happened to me was James Treadwell and James Peden.
Yep.
Hired me at Treadwell Farm to Table Cuisine in Niagara-on-the-Lake. And so I just finished my WSET, but I hadn't even taken a look at a sommelier certification. But I'd finished my WSET and I'd been working at Creekside Estate Winery and had some fabulous wines there. They're, you know, great
Syrah.
Their
Syrahs, I think, are some of the best value price ones in Ontario.
Yeah, agreed. And the Queenston Road Vineyard and those kind of old plantings there go a long way to that for sure. So definitely was very privileged to taste a lot of cool wine at Creekside. But then when I moved over to Treadwell, I would say probably 2009 Rosamel Vineyard Pinot Noir from Hidden Bench. So at the time, this would have been 2017. So you know, for me, that was kind of the first quote-unquote old wine, and we had a good amount of that, and we I think it was on the list for like $180 or something like that, which for me was incomprehensible.
Yeah.
How everyone could spend that much money on a bottle of wine. So we had a good bit of it, and you know, when you open a bottle of wine, speaking of service and hospitality, the super important part of the sommelier profession is to physically taste a bottle of wine when you open it, for a variety of reasons. But I remember tasting those wines when I opened them, and that was a moment where I said, okay, yeah, there's something here. Mm-hmm. And then I would say probably the other one, also at Treadwell, turns out that's a great place to drink old Niagara wine, would have been 2003 vintage of Cave Spring CSV Riesling. So the CSV block is some of their oldest plantings. I found it kind of what's the south side of their vineyard, so the closest part to the escarpment there. And I maintain to this day, you know, all the other, you know, new kids on the block in Niagara that people get very excited about. But I've always flown the flag for Cave Spring for Niagara Riesling. So yeah, I mean, certainly I think you move as a sommelier, you're forced to move past Niagara wine at some point. But when I was kind of first getting into, you know, service and hospitality and within the focus of wine, I think those are probably the two wines that stood out.
Is it easier? And I do promise in this, because the original one of the reasons why I want to have you on is just the wine competitions, which I think people find really interesting. Or maybe it's just me. And if it is, it's just me, that's fine. Is it easier selling old Niagara wine at Treadwell than it is at a Toronto restaurant?
Yes. Plain and simply, yes. Niagara is quite proud of their product.
Yeah,
for obvious reasons. Yeah, for obvious reasons. So, I'm just speaking again about Treadwell. You know, that was a place where people would come to drink Niagara wine, mm-hmm, with Niagara cuisine. And
yeah,
so that was the focus there. You know, we had a small section of the list, I would say, of international wines, because you need to have those. But most diners were there. Well, as tourism, I mean, we saw a fair amount of tourism along with, you know, great local crowd at their restaurant. But, you know, tourists come to drink Niagara wine. So, yeah, I think it's roughly 1,000% easier to sell Niagara wine in Niagara than it is in Toronto.
Would you ever be... Now, you would never do this because for you, it is always about great service. Me, I would always be tempted when someone says, I don't want Canadian wine. I'm going to take Pinot from... You know, I just want this Burgundy, or, you know, from Oregon or New Zealand, and pouring a really good, you know, like Clausenchase or Batchelder or whatever your favorite Ontario Pinot is. You ever be tempted just to pour it because you know that person, like, oh no, this is great, thank you. And it'd be, to me, it's always fantasizing that it'd be a good way to sort of just aggressively teach someone that maybe it's okay to open your mind a little bit.
I mean, yeah, you've hit on a couple of interesting points there. One is that blind tasting is the best way to evaluate wines, mm-hmm, plain and simply. The slightly more, you know, rigid service and hospitality answer is, you know, it would depend on what that guest had asked for, mm-hmm, right? If they had asked me for, you know, Oregon Pinot, that was a little bit on the lighter and fresher side, or, you know, something like... maybe Victoria Pinot Noir from Australia. Yeah, maybe that's a fair lateral, but, you know, you would be doing that guest a disservice if they said, oh, you know, my favorite thing to drink is, you know, really dense, meaty Gevrey Chambertin Pinot Noir, or I love just really round, plush Russian River Valley Pinot Noir. That would be an unfair lateral, but Yeah, I think there is a ton of value in pouring things blind. It's why some of these taste things blind literally all the time. It's not just because it's a party trick. It's because if you want to evaluate a product, you have to do a blend.
Yeah, get the labels off and just get it all the way. So I was looking at the website for CAPS, for the Best Ontario Sommelier Competition, and this was before it started, and a quote from James Pedden, where he said, "We're proud of these finalists," which you were one of, "and look forward to intense, high-level competition for the finals." So, Nathan, what does intense/high-level competition look like in a SOM competition?
I think the biggest source of intensity is the not knowing part. So this was my first wine competition.
Oh, was it really?
It was my first wine competition. So I had no idea what to expect. And that's kind of the point. I mean, even if you gain more experience to what I understand, you know, there's such a wide scope of what you could be asked to evaluate. And so it makes studying a little bit difficult. I'll tell you very plainly, one of the biggest things I was worried about for the Best Ontario Sommelier Competition was spirits, because I used to do a lot more kind of service bartending in my day-to-day life, but I obviously a little bit more specialized in wine at this point. So I was a little bit worried about spirits. And so, you know, Justin and I at work the previous weekend had done some blind spirits lineup, just organizing by alcohol and by base material. And then I'll tell you, yeah, very plainly, at home at 11 or so in the morning before I caught my Uber down to the Liberty Grand, and I had my roommate pour six blind, I think, were they all whiskeys? I think they might have all been whiskeys, but in a range from 40, so standard proof, to something cask strength, so 64% alcohol, mm-hmm. just to see if I could actually hit that level of alcohol detection. And I'm not sure that we were asked anything about spirits on that afternoon. So, you know, I'm certainly the spirits, you know, served well for,
how'd you do? You know, how'd you do, by the way, on that pre-Uber? How'd you do on the spirits identification?
Pretty good. I mean, cask strength hits it pretty good. And so, you know, that's pretty easy. My roommate, I think unknowingly, but rather cruelly, put the cask strength spirit as the first thing in the lineup.
Oh, that's not
right. Which really burns your lips.
Yeah.
I was a little discombobulated for the rest of that flight. And so anyhow, you know, it probably wasn't as helpful as it could have been. But, you know, I mean, aside from blind tasting, you know, there's a picture slide portion. So, I mean, I wasn't expecting this speed, but we had 15 slides for 5 seconds each.
Okay.
To Oof. Identify
right.
pictures of vineyards, pictures of winemakers, pictures of things to do with viticulture. So a picture of a virus and a picture of some grapevines that were, you know, had some spotting on them and things like that. So, you know, it's not, you know, just going through a book and memorizing, you know, your list of things. Well, that's a big part of it, but you know, your picture recognition and service details and the rest of the beverage and hospitality world outside of wine. I think just because the scope is so wide, it's so hard to prepare effectively, especially for the first time.
Well, I've talked to people about this, about taking their the master level, and sometimes it's not about just your knowledge. There is a bit of luck involved where you could study everything, but then you're asked about some small producer in Greece, and that can just send you down a bad path. And I mean, there is a bit of luck involved, as you said, because it's a wide scope. And I know the questions are trying to do it so that it can lead you to a logical answer, even if you don't know every appellation in a certain area. There is a bit of luck involved when it comes, because I've seen people that have failed a section, and I'm like, you're the smartest person I know. You're putting in 6 hours of study a day. So sometimes it's just that randomness.
Yeah, I think the reality with theory is there's only one answer. So mm-hmm. you either know it or you don't.
Yeah.
Service is different, though. So in the service portion of the exams, part of the evaluation there is to your point, kind of being able to roll with it a little bit.
Yeah.
It would be impractical to use as a metric of success, oh, that candidate knew every single answer to every question, because that's not practical in life either.
Yeah.
The amount of times I'm on the floor at Don Alfonso and somebody asks me a question that I don't have the answer to right away. Mm-hmm. It's about being able to say what to, first of all, not lie about it.
Yes.
And then secondly, to be gracious and appreciative and say, you know, I would love to find that answer for you. But, you know, everyone can tell when they're being lied to. Well, many people can tell when they're being lied to a mile away. So, yeah, if you want to get a bad reputation, you just try to lie your way through situations, yeah, versus that, just, you know, finding the answer. Like, that, you know, everything's in our pockets now, but it wasn't, you know, that long ago where, you know, you would have to use encyclopedias and indexes and map books, but those are called reference books because you have to refer to them on an ongoing basis. So yeah, there's this kind of, it's a different deal in service where you just try to make sure the guests have a good time.
So how was the rest of your experience on the competition? 15 flashcards, 5 seconds each. Mm-hmm. How'd it go for you for the service side, for the blind? I think I was talking to Justin about, I think the blind was all different sparklings.
3 different sparkling wines, asked to evaluate residual sugar production method and lees aging time for 3 products, and 3 minutes total for that exercise. So that was pretty brisk as well. That was fun. You know, it's funny, like, looking back on it, it was a very good reminder to trust my gut. You know, there's the knee jerk feeling you have on when you first, you know, evaluate a product, and then there's, you know, you think about it and you try to think a little bit logically, and you try to, you know, you start to hedge your bets a little bit. And there's definitely a couple of instances looking back where I said, yeah, I wish I just trusted my gut a little bit more there.
Yeah.
And I mean, in service, you know, I mean, you always feel terrible about how you conducted service, you know, little steps that you missed just because it's, you know, you're in a room and you're on stage and you have this mic pack on your back or whatever. And on your back. And then this, like, the dongle in your kind of peripheral vision here on your jawline there, which is strange. So yeah, you know, you're put in a slightly unnatural environment. And so it was not surprising, but it was still a little bit, I don't know. It was still a little bit surprising, even though I was expecting to just forget some of the most basic elements of stuff I do every day, right? Well, so it's just a pressure environment.
I mean, first off, good on you for getting to the finals. So this is your first, like, you know, wine competition. It can be pretty intense and intimidating. So good on you, you know, for getting that far. One thing I've noticed, when I was doing my research, you're not on social media very much, are you?
No, I'm not.
You're no Twitter.
No Twitter.
The last time you put something on Instagram, I think you were in Croatia.
Yes.
And by the way, shame on you. You should have, after Canada lost to Croatia, I was like, that's it. No Plavek Mali for me for a month. I am out of respect for Team Canada losing 3-1.
Of course.
But what I want to get to is one of your few Instagram posts was illusion versus reality when it comes to wine and social media. And you were studying for your Master of Port Canada exam, and one picture looked great, and a charcuterie board and the blue cheese and the port and the map out. And then the second picture was just the entire table where it was a complete mess. And I thought that was sort of interesting. I want to just sort of ask you about just, you know, the reality versus the illusion when it comes to studying for wine.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the blue cheese was shoved to the side, and it was a beer and a bag of chips or something like that. Besides something like that, there is this. I mean, part of, I think, the profession now is interacting on social media a little bit, and so when I have opportunities to go to events or go to places or participate in things, you know, I think part of it is recognizing that there are organizers and sponsors and people that put in a lot of time, effort, and money into making these things happen. So,
yeah,
you know, when I do something like, you know, a trip or an event or whatever, I try to post something. I'm not good enough as I should be at posting things, but I do try to, you know, give a nod to those people, because, you know, sponsorship dollars is how things happen. And, and even BOSC, Best Ontario Sommelier Competition, ran on the backs of sponsors, you know, too many to account, but people that donated, donated wines, people that donated their time, people that, you know, were, came and poured wine for consumers. You know, these events are very much run by people's kind of efforts and collaboration. So yeah, there is that part of me that tries to reciprocate that in a very, very small way by posting on social media. But yeah, the reality is everything is a little bit messy. I'm pretty you know, disorganized in my studying world, so it's a weird kind of combination of map wine atlases that are all written in, you know, smatterings of flashcards here and there. You know, I've been using just legal size pads and being a little bit more freeform on there as a method to try and integrate more things. There's definitely what appears on social media, and then there's all the, like, the gritty back work that happens. You know, a lot of my most productive time is when I get home from work at 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. I pour something to drink and then sit down with a book and just write stuff down, write flashcards, whatever the case may be.
Would it be safe to say, Nathan, in comparison to maybe a lot of other people in the business, like, and just hearing about your timeline, you still seem like, it's weird for me, I'm trying to figure this out, you still seem relatively young, early, I'm not sure the best way to put it, and yet your knowledge base, like when I see a Grand Cru and you're sitting there and describing like Martinborough versus Otago, and, you know, we're talking about all these New Zealand wines, and you're just like bang, 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 and just rapid fire knowledge and confidence. Is it fair to say you've really just accelerated your wine knowledge over the last couple of years?
I think I'm fairly young. I'm 28. And so, yeah, you know, I've been fortunate, and a number of people have given me great opportunities along the way. So, you know, James Treadwell and James Peden at Treadwell, Bruce Wallner at Sommelier Factory, and getting in teaching, that was a great way to accelerate. And now moving into the head sommelier role at Don Alfonso, and, you know, coming full circle to work with James Peden again. Yep. You know, being in the right situations and just working hard and always trying to make myself a little bit uncomfortable has been a great way to accelerate that. You know, moved into Treadwell as an uncertified sommelier, started at Sommelier Factory and hadn't taught before. Don Alfonso is a Michelin star restaurant that I'm trying to kind of rise to the level of and steward and respect that program and the effort that's gone into it thus forth. So yeah, I like making myself be a little bit uncomfortable, because then you have no other option but to work and study and kind of keep moving. So
it's true. It is a great way to accelerate your knowledge is to do that. Man, fear is a hell of a motivator. So people ask, what is it being like, your title with Don Alfonso, and you said, if we're not head somm, but you're in charge. Yeah. Head somm. So yeah. Head somm of Don Alfonso. For people who don't know, what is that like? What is a day, a week in the life of being the head somm for a restaurant as you know, highly acclaimed as Don Alfonso?
The only difference, Don Alfonso, between head sommelier and any of our other sommeliers, of which we have many, Justin, Stefano, Jen Huther has been pulling corks with us lately. Paige McIntyre is here as well. The only difference between me and everybody else is I show up earlier to receive deliveries and do the admin and make sure the menu's accurate and make sure things are organized. It's not quite the, you know, the French system of, you know, oh, there's the respected, you know, lauded head sommelier, and then everybody else is, you know, under them in terms of knowledge. Yeah. You know, yeah, I work on a team where every single person is so sharp and so dialed in. I mean, Justin, as you know, as your listeners will know, just passed his MS theory earlier this year.
Yeah.
He either is a master sommelier. Our wine director, Jules Garten, is an event sommelier. So, you know, it's definitely not a position where, you know, the head sommelier is more knowledgeable.
Right.
It's just, I'm, you know, gonna try and, you know, do the legwork and the administration and all the work on the back end to make sure that, you know, our team can just not have to worry about stuff when they come in. And when right. they come into work every day, they just focus on pulling corks, doing pairings, creating great experiences for our guests.
What excites you at on the list at Don Alfonso?
We have an amazing collection of back vintage wines at the moment. We, fortunately, Liberty Group has the resources to do you know, some great buying at auctions. And so, you know, in Ontario, it's tough to get older wines. You know, we don't have these great domains in our backyard to just purchase back vintages ex cellar. So in Ontario, you know, you have to basically go through the auction route to get old wine.
Oh, so Iron Gate is a big part of what you guys do.
And Waddington's.
Yeah. Can you do me a favor? Just could you not bid on New Zealand and Germany? Because those are the places that I try to pluck wines where I can get value. And I'm on a losing streak right now. So if you see any Kimu River, could you just pass on
sure,
it just once?
Sure, yeah.
You know, I'm not asking much.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely a Don Alfonso. Our focus is Italian and French, although you'll be in bidding against German wine. You won't be bidding against me, but you'll be in stiff competition for all sommeliers for their personal buying.
Yes, exactly.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
You know what? I haven't brought this question up in a little while. It's a stereotype, but it's a stereotype based on truth. I've yet to meet someone who works in the wine industry, someone who's studied, someone who's accredited. We all say the same thing. We all love Riesling, and we all secretly get angry that more people don't drink it. Like, what is it about just Riesling? It's almost like 100% approval rate of anyone within the industry.
Yeah, it is. certainly there's some grapes that seem a little bit more capable of creating wines that move from the great and into the profound. Riesling is one of them for sure. There's no logical reason why the general consumer should be straying away from Riesling, but it's not a problem that I'm looking to fix.
Yeah. You know, let's go back to port for a second.
Sure.
You studied for it. Favorite port, and why should people have more of it in their home?
I've always been partial to Dow's, the Ruby line from Dow's, be it the LBV or vintage bottlings. I prefer my ports a little bit drier and spicier, and so Dow's ferments a little bit drier during their production process, which is something I'm quite fond of. People should have more port. Look, part of the Master of Port competition was to raise the awareness of the versatility of port throughout the meal rather than just as the dessert to pair with the blue cheese,
right,
as has been classically understood. I think there's merit to those. I think what I will say is if you'd like to pour port during your dinner, I think you can do that. Although I think you do have to reverse engineer that and make sure that your cuisine would complement. So using fruits in sauces, making sure there's plenty of richness on the plate. Being a fortified wine that carries varying levels of sweetness, yeah, there is it does get pigeonholed a little bit. I actually legitimately, personally just enjoy drinking it on its own.
Hell yeah.
Very recreationally. So, you know, I think the movement to try and kind of lighten it up and make it more versatile has a lot of merit. It's personally not how I enjoy my port, but they're very undervalued wines. What other region can you go to in the world and get their top wines for, in most cases, under $200 a bottle?
Yeah.
Right? you know, you could point to, okay, sure, you could do that in Alsace. In, I guess, in Germany, Riesling sometimes with exceptions. But, you know, if your reference point for, you know, dense, concentrated, full-bodied reds is something like Bordeaux or California, and you can manage to tolerate a little bit of sweetness, you should be looking at wines from Port and from the Douro for that reason.
100%. Okay, let's for people listening to this who are getting into wine, don't have a ton of money, but are you know, looking to just expand, a region that, an undervalued a region that that you love for just value wines.
Portugal, for sure. I would say Croatia. We're going to start to see more on our market as well. In both cases, regions that haven't always been the most affluent. I mean, Croatia is only a recent arrival to the European Union. Portugal has been around in the European Union for a little bit longer, but kind of only now in both cases we're seeing kind of investment coming into both places. So, you know, when you have a region that has regions that have over 100 years of grape growing experience under their belt, but a comparatively shorter amount of time being successful and competitive in the export market, that's how you know you got potential for something special. And that's the case in both places.
For Portugal, is the problem that, at least this more from a marketing standpoint, they don't have the tentpole grape, and maybe that's going to be Trigo Nacional. But it feels to me that like can sometimes be the problem with port is when you're just getting into wine, you like to know, oh, that's a Merlot. I've heard that word. That's a Cabernet. That's a Chard. That's a Pinot. And in Portugal, it's often it's a field blend or it's a grape you've never heard of.
Yeah. I mean, the field blend thing goes back to the fact that it is a little bit emerging market. And, you know, they say, oh, it's a field blend because it is like it's just a blend of grapes that are kind of mashed together in the vineyard circa well before they had the resources to do DNA profiling on plants. So yeah, there is this kind of rusticity to Portuguese wine. Your comment about international grapes is interesting. I think many consumers, I think, do find comfort in seeing within the context of a blend Merlot or in a white blend Chardonnay. That can be helpful, although I think, you know, Greece is actually a great blueprint for how to make your wines more competitive in the export market when maybe your wine and your language is a little bit more creative with its use of consonants. It's whittled down. I mean, Greece has, you know, three figures in terms of the number of indigenous grapes in Germany, or in Greece, excuse me. They were very wise in all of their marketing materials reflect three white and three red grapes. And they really whittled it down and became very focused. And so for the consumer to say, okay, well, look at all of these islands and regions in Greece. Look at all these grapes. They said, no, don't worry about that. See if you like it first, but here's three and three.
Yeah.
Portugal's got to do the same thing. I think they're on their way to that. You know, I mean, the Alvarinho, Loureiro, Trechadoro wines in the north, Trigo Nacional, Trigo Franca wines, I think, make compelling full-bodied. So I think they're on the way to that. But yeah, becoming a little bit more focused in just highlighting indigenous wines. Because at the end of the day, do we need 20 emerging markets to all be putting Merlot out? No, of course not. We need these places to be a little bit more focused about picking the indigenous grapes that make them special and isolating the ones that have the best promise and bringing them to the market.
Yeah. Get people in, and then when someone starts loving these Portuguese wines, then they can go and do their own exploration and find the funky stuff afterwards. How tough is and maybe, I mean, Don Alfonso's different. You guys are going to be busy all the time. So you guys don't have the same impact when it's Christmas. Suddenly things get busier. But as someone who's been in service for so long, how different is December versus other months?
It is different. Yeah, in some ways people are more celebratory. But in some ways people are also budget conscious. You know, I mean, people, you know, are want to do, you know, special events, but, you know, people also have to do 10 special events per season, right? So you know, there, I think there is this like small illusion that, you know, everybody in hospitality really starts licking their chops and dusting off their most expensive wines for the Christmas season. You know, there are certainly some people who will do that, but you know, at the end of the day, there's just this, the focus is the same, and the reality is people just want to come in and eat and drink. And so, yeah, I mean, as you've said, for us, it's not like we're going to be busier. Maybe the scope is a little bit different, but yeah, I mean I push champagne 12 months out of the year, because yeah, I think it's one of the great wines that gets underappreciated. So, you know, my verbiage doesn't change, but I guess maybe other people sell more champagne. I think that's a sensible move. But then again, the same as the reasoning problem, I don't want more people to start buying champagne all year round as well. So
maybe you want to hoard it for yourself.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I don't want to get you to edit that.
Well, it reminded me when I was in Vienna, and we were drinking all these great Austrian red wines, and it's at this little tiny little restaurant, and I'm talking to some people there, and I'm like, why aren't these wines more, why don't we get more of them? And they told me, shut up, because once you guys start liking them, we're gonna have to export it out to you, and the price is gonna go up. We like it the way it is right now. Mm-hmm. But I would tell anyone, if you find Saint Laurent, give it a shot. It's a really good really good Austrian red wine. So what's your point of attack for the advance? Do you have sort of a way you want to attack this in terms of just knowledge, tasting groups, maps, 1,000 flashcards? I think people out there that are looking to start studying, whether it's either in the court or Master Sommelier or WSET, but just what is your sort of plan of attack?
Yeah. One of the things that I learned at the Court of Master Sommeliers advanced course in Dallas earlier this year was you got to integrate your studying a little bit. And what I mean by that is what I'm trying to change now is moving from just rote memorization and having a massive stack of flashcards and memorizing all of these different things in isolation. I want to be able to have that information all integrated a little bit more. So, you know, if I'm looking at, what's a good example? If I'm looking at Syrah, okay, so let's take a look at some of the reference point regions for that Northern Rhone. Take a look at the Appalachians. And then also be integrating, okay, well, what's the geography and climate? How does that manifest in the vineyard? How does history and producer style manifest in the vineyard? I don't want to just go through and memorize and try to, you know, create these, you know, maybe these false paradigms to say, oh, okay, well, you know, Koroti is always more aromatic than the more muscular Hermitage. Okay, well, why?
Yeah.
What are the factors that go into that? So yeah. I think to move from just pure information collecting to understanding the reasons that things are the way that they are, for me, has been helpful. So that goes back to the, you know, the using the big legal pad. I want to be, when I'm taking a look at a topic, I want to be bringing in a lot more factors other than just, you know, clinging to these old adages and understandings that were published 25 years ago. You know?
So it's not just about the statistic. The statistic is the flashcard. Mm-hmm. It's the story behind the statistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if someone asks you, well, why? Mm-hmm. Like you should have an answer for that.
Yeah.
Rather than just saying, oh yeah, well,
that's, you know, how it is.
Yeah. That's how it is. Like yeah, that's not a good answer. Yeah. So yeah, I've been enjoying the process of just trying to take a look at the whys and still, I mean, let's be perfectly clear, you know, the CMS advanced level exam is still very much focused on the information collecting stage.
Right.
The why stuff is really the MS level, mm-hmm, in fairness. But I want to get a head start on that.
Yeah.
And for me, that's like, that's how I want to work. And I mean, to your point about it, always back to service and hospitality, you know, it doesn't do our guests any favors for me to have memorized things because mm-hmm. they have phones that can tell them the information faster than I can anyhow.
Right.
So the sommelier doesn't need to impress diners by having, you know, the Premier Cruise memorized north to south in the villages every summertime, right? That's not good information. But being able to tell someone, okay, well, why is that wine different? Or why is that producer different? Or why is that wine double the price of that one? Yeah, saying that's how it is not a good answer to that. So yeah. Understanding the whys is back to service and hospitality.
Yeah, and that's kind of where it all leads to, and kind of where it leads to here. By the way, when I did my diploma for WSET, I could have told you all the Premier Cruise. Now, eventually that kind of stuff just flies away.
And I don't think you lost any sleep over not having that on deck anymore.
I haven't really, but at the same time, every now and then when I'm looking at a map, I'm like, because again, I'm still a nerd. I'll be like, oh, I wish I remember them all. As we end this, so the advanced, now I'm not going to do the where you see yourself in five years, bleep that. But for people out there that want to check out some of the restaurants, my recommendation for Don Alfonso, make a reservation now for several months, try on a weekday. And you know what? 5 p.m. is a delightful time to go have a dinner because, you'll get to watch the sunset because it's gorgeous up there. But what are some of the other restaurants from your guys' group that you'd recommend?
I don't go out to eat steak a lot in restaurants because I'm of the mindset that I can walk down to any of the number of great butchers in the city, buy a great piece of meat, put salt on it,
yes,
and then sear it as hard as I can in a pan, sure. But what is fun is the satirical steakhouse, right? The white tablecloths, the seafood towers, the baked potatoes, things like that, right? That's fun. And so again, when you're moving from service to hospitality, it's about an experience. Going to a steakhouse where they embrace that, like, kind of a little bit funny, but like also, man, this is just kind of really fun.
Yeah.
Steakhouse, I think, is great. Like, Barbarians has been doing it forever, but Barbarians isn't in a castle. And so Blue Blood Steakhouse is
It's so cool there.
Like, that's a cool thing, right? Yeah. There's like original Warhols on the walls. Yeah. And you know, they got the whole bit there. The cellar is quite literally under, like, in the basement in the castle, right? So, you know, that's a fun experience.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's fun. When you go out for a dining experience, you look for experiences. So I think that's really fun. You know, where do I go to eat as well? You know, it's equal parts looking for experiences and then also just like looking to do something super casual. Like, I'll tell you very plainly, I don't go out to a lot of restaurants and, you know, order bottles of wine. Like, I go to a pho place and have a beer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I spend a lot of time on the Ossington Strip where I live very close by to, you know, eating pho. I think Dilo is a great restaurant for something a little bit more experiential in the city. The guys at Pompette are doing such great work as well. Speaking of a place that cares about hospitality, I think Pompette's doing a really amazing work. But I think the restaurant groups that are setting themselves apart in the city are the ones that are creating experiences for diners rather than just a meal.
Nathan, I really appreciate you doing this. And it's super impressive how far you've come in a short period of time under the age of 30. I look forward to seeing what you do over the next 5-10 years.
Thanks, Matthew. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.